one of the six famous philosophies,
Sadarshans. So there are six. There are these six famous philosophies traditionally in India. There's Gautama's Nyaya, his logic. There's Kanada's Vaisheshika, and then there are various others. And they're all attempting, actually, to describe the absolute truth. But we're interested not in these superficial attempts, but we're interested in the ultimate reality and, as it's very nicely described in Srimad Bhagavatam. So let's go on to 51. So now he starts getting into it. What is the nature of this absolute reality? And of course, implicit in that is the idea that what is the nature of this absolute reality in terms of how it's described in Srimad Bhagavatam? Yeah, because that's our source. So how does Srimad Bhagavatam describe the absolute reality? So Suta Goswami answers by speaking Srimad Bhagavatam 1:2:11, famous verse, Vedanti tat tatva vidas, tatvam yajjnanam advayam, Brahmeti paramatmeti bhagavaniti shabjate. We also mentioned this the other day, how that verse, along with Ede Chamsa Kalapam Sakrishna Stu Bhagavan Swayam, those two verses are particularly important in terms of understanding what is the message of the Bhagavatam, what is the Bhagavatam about. Ede Chamsa Kalapam Sa 1:3:28 is more important, really, because it's specifically pointing to Krishna. But then this verse, 1:2:11, follows very closely afterwards in describing the three aspects of Krishna. Learned transcendentalists who know the absolute truth call this non-dual substance, this non-dual knowledge, Brahman, Paramatma, and Bhagavan. So now, Jiva Goswami is just focusing on a particular little phrase or particular little statement within that verse. Tatvam yaj jnanam advayam. Jnanam advayam. The knowers of that absolute reality call it non-dual consciousness. He's just beginning a discussion. He is not saying that the knowers of that absolute reality call it Krishna, but step by step he's going to go into it. So the first characteristic of that absolute reality, that real ultimate vastu, is jnanam advayam, non-dual consciousness, absolute consciousness. That is like a fundamental aspect, very fundamental aspect of this absolute reality, which of course is Krishna, but we're going to come to that point after some time. But first characteristic to note is Advaya Gyan, non-dual consciousness. Here, the word jnana refers to that entity whose nature is exclusively pure consciousness. This pure spirit is called non-dual for the following reasons. One, there is nothing else, either similar or dissimilar, that is self-existent. This is the absolute reality. If you had something else which was self-existent, then whatever we're talking about here could not be the absolute reality. Because absolute means that it is unique. Then you'd have, you know, a dual reality, or maybe a triple or multiple type of reality. Not some ultimate and absolute reality, but here we're talking about the absolute ultimate reality. So it is called non-dual and absolute for the following reasons. One, there's nothing else which is self-existent of any type. Two, it takes support only from its own potencies. So does that mean it is now dependent then? That would tend to indicate that it's not so absolute. But no. Three, these potencies can have no existence without it as their absolute foundation. So even though it is connected with its own potencies and is interacting with its own potencies, but its potencies are totally dependent upon it. So there you have a definition, an interesting definition, yeah, of what is the absolute reality. And it's a very wonderful definition, actually. The term tattva here implies the idea of the supreme goal of human life. Thus, we understand that this tattva, or absolute reality, is also the embodiment of the highest bliss and is therefore also eternal. Those are deductions he's analyzing further. It is not exactly stated in that verse that this absolute reality is also the embodiment of the highest bliss or that it is eternal, but it is just implicit there. It is implicit that if it is the absolute reality, if it is self-existent, and everything else is dependent upon it, it has to be eternal. If it was not eternal, that would mean that it is subject to time. But no, time is one of its potencies. It may interact with time, but time is completely dependent upon it. So it must be eternal. And it must be also the embodiment of the highest bliss, because happiness is generally the goal of life in one form or another, be it, you know, what do they say, what is it, Vijnana Maya Ananda, how does it begin, what's the first one, Anamaya, then what is the next one, Jnanamaya, Vijnana Maya and Ananda Maya, yeah. So it all means happiness, that they're all talking about perspectives that people may have on life, on reality. First, and it's all in terms of happiness. Anamaya. What is my life about? Eating. Anna. That is where my happiness is situated. Or in my intelligence. Or in my mind, or wherever it may be. Or in Anandamaya, that ultimate source of ecstasy. So, this is then implicit. Tattvam yajjnanam advayam. That tattva, which consists of advaya jnan, that reality, that truth, it also embodies the highest bliss, and it is necessarily eternal. All right. Let's go on to 52. Now he's going to really start getting into it a bit more. So this is, yeah, anyway, we have to listen a little carefully here. Read carefully. One may question, but events of consciousness are seen to exist only briefly, taking the shape, say, of a blue object one moment and a yellow object the next. How then can consciousness be called the non-dual and eternal theme of this scripture, Srimad Bhagavatam? This is an objection from not exactly the Mayavadis, who we heard objections from earlier, but this is an objection actually from the Buddhists. Yes, the Buddhists in the time of Jiva Goswami, they were still somewhat active. I think they've become less active now. But in those days, they were somewhat prominent. So he has to, along with countering the Mayavadi's ideas, he wants to counter some of their ideas. In fact, this is a particular group of Buddhists. The Buddhists, as they were existing in India at that time, they were not exactly like the very traditional Buddhists. They were a bit of a merger between the Buddhists and the Mayavadis. And they're called the Kshanik Vijnanavadis. They're kind of a merger of Buddhists and Mayavadis. Kshanik Vijnanavadis. So they say that consciousness cannot be the highest reality or part of it, because consciousness is not constant. Now I'm conscious of Ekalavya, Prabhu. Now I'm conscious of the fan. So that consciousness of Ekalavya was there, but then it went. Now there's another consciousness. So, they're saying here that sometimes you're conscious of a blue object. So that consciousness is there, blue object consciousness. Then a yellow object comes along, then I become yellow object conscious. And the blue object consciousness is gone. So they say that consciousness then is just another fluctuating part of this greater fluctuating material nature, the greater illusion, or it's all a big illusion, it doesn't exist. But our idea is that consciousness is eternal. So let us then address this point or see how Jiva Goswami does. So Suta Goswami replies, this Bhagavatam, because the idea is that they're asking, how could if the Bhagavatam is about the absolute reality, how could consciousness be that, be the subject matter of the Bhagavatam? Because as far as we're concerned, it is not like that. It couldn't be like that. It's just some temporary factor. But Suta Goswami replies, this Bhagavatam is the essence of all Vedanta philosophy because its subject matter is the absolute truth, which, while non-different from the spirit soul, this is a very important point to note, both the supreme absolute reality, the ultimate vastu, and the individual soul, they both share consciousness. So, this Bhagavatam is the essence of all Vedanta philosophy because its subject matter is the absolute truth, which, while non-different from the spirit soul, is the ultimate reality, one without a second. The goal of this literature is exclusive devotional service unto that supreme truth. So, despite what these Buddhists say, still it is a fact that Bhagavatam maintains that this conscious absolute truth, which shares this quality of consciousness with the spirit soul, is actually what the Bhagavatam is about, and that devotional service to that absolute truth is like encouraging devotional service to that absolute truth is the goal of this literature. It's trying to get people to do that. So now, to support his point that the absolute truth is conscious and that the living entities are also non-different, at least as far as consciousness is concerned, being conscious is concerned, to support this, Jiva Goswami is now going to quote a whole lot of verses from the Shruti, from the Upanishads, basically. So the Shruti has defined the nature of this absolute truth, Brahman. Of course, this means ultimately Krishna, but in the Upanishads, they express it as Brahman. But as we said the other day, we understand that when the Vedic scriptures talk about Brahman, in terms of the realization of Vyas, or Shukadeva, particularly Vyas, then we take that Brahman to simply be a feature of Krishna. But anyway, we'll just read in terms of how the Upanishads speak directly. But we'll understand that behind the scenes they're indicating Krishna. So, they say, the Supreme Brahman is infinite truth and knowledge. That's Taittiriya Upanishad. That Brahman is the sole cause of the entire creation, is shown by such Shruti statements as, by hearing about which Brahman, everything is heard. So first of all, the first statement says that this Brahman is infinite truth and knowledge. In other words, this Shruti statement is supporting the point of view that this absolute truth is non-dual consciousness, infinite truth and knowledge. And now the second verse, Chandogya Upanishad, is saying that this same absolute truth, which is confirmed in the previous statement as non-dual consciousness, infinite truth and knowledge, it is the sole cause of the entire creation. You see, it's supporting those statements made in the previous verse, defining those three statements, defining defining what is that absolute non-dual reality. And then also some further statements from Chantogya Upanishad. By hearing about which Brahman everything is heard, by knowing which Brahman everything is known, and my boy, in the beginning there was only Sat, the eternal reality. And of course Sat, we know, is taken to be non-different from Brahman, Om Tat Sat. That the Supreme Brahman achieves everything simply by his desire is shown by the statement, he glanced and desired, let me become many. Eko Bahu Syam. I am one, but let me become many. So, like this, here we are getting confirmations from Shruti about how non-dual consciousness is the absolute truth, is the ultimate cause of everything. Everything is dependent upon it. You follow the idea? As we had heard in verse 50, basically. So then another statement from Chandogya Upanishad. And now he's going to bring in the jiva specifically. In the statement, along with this individual living entity, I shall manifest name and form. The living entity jiva is mentioned in connection with and as belonging to that supreme, which is called Brahman because it is greater than all else in essence and potencies. Or in other words, Krishna, ultimately. But here, we're using the Upanishadic language, so we're calling it Krishna Brahman. Here, the pronoun idam, this, differentiates the jiva from Brahman, but the word atmana, self, indicates that the jiva is part and parcel of Brahman. According to what was revealed in Srila Vyasadeva's trance, the living entity is one with the Supreme Brahman in the sense of not being completely different from him. Well, that non-difference is there in the sense of consciousness, their spiritual nature, eternal spiritual conscious nature. Such Shruti statements as Tat Twamasi, you are that, from Chandogya Upanishad, reveal that the oneness of the Supreme Brahman with the jiva consists of their both being purely spiritual by virtue of the jiva's status as a particle of the Supreme Brahman. Understanding this idea helps one acquire preliminary knowledge of the Supreme Brahman. That is what we're going into, you see. Now we're going to be discussing the jiva and how that will then reflect on our understanding of the Supreme Brahman. Okay, the entity thus designated as the Supreme Brahman, who is the essence of all the Upanishads and is one without a second, is the focus of interest, the exclusive subject matter of the Srimad Bhagavatam. Here we understand the statement, this Srimad Bhagavatam, to be implied by the syntactic connection with that same phrase in one of the preceding verses, 12.3.10. In other words, in 12.3.10, it doesn't actually mention the Bhagavatam specifically, but it is referring to the Bhagavatam, which was specifically mentioned two verses before. So how does that sound? This 12.3.12, let me just read that again. This Bhagavatam is the essence of all Vedanta philosophy, because its subject matter is the absolute truth, which, while non-different from the spirit soul, is the ultimate reality, one without a second. The goal of this literature is exclusive devotional service unto that supreme truth. Okay. So despite what the Kshanik Vijnanavadis, the Buddhists, say about consciousness, denying the absolute position of consciousness, but the Vedic scriptures, the Bhagavatam itself and the Vedic scriptures also, they confirm that actually the absolute truth is non-dual consciousness, and that also there is a jiva who shares certain characteristics, eternal spiritual consciousness. So let us go on to 52.2. The following analogy helps clarify the above idea. The above idea is now the idea of the oneness or the relationship. The relationship, the connection between the jiva and the absolute truth. That is the above idea. Suppose a person has been kept in a dark room from birth and has never seen the sun. When he wants to know what the sun is, someone points to a ray of sunlight passing through a window grating and says, "That is the sun." Try to understand that the sun is a great orb of light of the same substance as this ray, which is a portion of it. In the Paramatma Sandarbha, we will establish that the jiva is simply a fractional portion of the Supreme Brahman, manifested by one of his inconceivable potencies. So, of course, Jiva Goswami, he has chosen this verse. Anyway, let us put it this way. This verse is an extremely famous verse amongst the Mayavadis and so many people like that. It is taken to be the Mahavakya, or the most important of all mantras by the Mayavadis. Tat Tvam Asi. That, Tat, that, Tvam, you, Asi, you are. You are that. Of course, the Mayavadis take it that you are that means that it's totally all one, and that you are simply part of that oneness. But here in 52.2, Jiva Goswami has very nicely explained that, the understanding. In line with other statements from the same book, Chandogya Upanishad, where in that, second paragraph up, from the bottom of 52.1, he quotes Chandogya Upanishad, that along with this individual living entity, I shall manifest name and form. So there is a difference. There's the absolute truth. There is I, in this context, I, that Supreme Brahman who is speaking, that I will become many, that I will manifest along with the living entity, the jiva. So when he says, Tat Tvam Asi, the understanding has to reflect that difference. So therefore, Jiva Goswami gives this example. It's a famous example, actually. The cave dweller example. That a person who's been trapped in a dark place all his life, he doesn't understand what is the sun, but there's one little beam of sunlight somehow coming through. Then the person who's trying to convey the idea can say, oh, it's like that. It's much bigger. This is just a little spark, little energy of it. But it's like that. Tat Tvam Asi. And you are like that. In a very small way. It is the ultimate supreme consciousness. And you are small consciousness. But you are conscious and you are eternal. 52.3. Thus. So we've covered, as far as the commentary goes there, the objections from the Buddhists, we've talked about that a little. That's going to come up in the following verses. We've talked about Tat Tvam Asi. Now 52.3 is going to summarize the concept of the oneness and difference of the jivas and the absolute truth. Thus, when the Upanishads say that the Supreme Brahman has parts, they mean that one of his characteristics is to be endowed with the part and parcel living beings and other energies. But that is not all they say. Conversely, when the Shrutis speak of him as having no parts, they're focusing on his exclusive essence. In other words, Krishna is everywhere. He's within every atom. But Krishna is in Goloka Vrindavan. He never takes a step out of Vrindavan. So two ways of understanding. That when he is spoken of in the sense of having parts, that's referring to his expansions and energies. But when it refers to him in the sense of just being and a unique one entity, then it's referring to him on his own. In the fourth line of Srimad Bhagavatam 12, 13, 12, namely, Kaivalyaika Prayojanam. The word Kaivalya, oneness simply means purity. Later in the Preeti Sandarbha, we will demonstrate that this purity is none other than pure devotional service. And this verse was spoken by Suta Goswami. So there we have it. The absolute vastu, that ultimate tattva, that ultimate truth, is Advaya Gyan, non-dual consciousness. It shares that with the jivas. So now, from 53 to 55, we are going to focus on the nature of the jivas and then get some idea of how that reflects, what that indicates about the nature of the absolute truth. Then one can easily understand how the Supreme Brahman, Tat, has a similar nature. Because it's a lot easier to understand you than the Supreme Absolute Truth, isn't it? It should be. You know, we are ourselves, so hopefully we can understand ourselves. And if we can understand ourselves properly, not in terms of false ego and material identification, but in terms of our true identity, then that will help us understand the absolute truth. Seeing we share natures in, at least in certain very important respects. To make just this point, in accordance with the reasoning of Vedanta Sutra 1320, which says that one contemplates the jiva in order to know the other, the supreme, sage Pipalayana describes the jiva as having the same nature as Tat when he says to King Nimi in Bhagavatam 11.3.38. So, of course, we all know that the Bhagavatam is the natural commentary on Vedanta Sutra. We all know that. We all know that the first verse, or practically the first verse in Vedanta Sutra, is Janmad Yasya Yataha. We all know that the first verse of the Bhagavatam begins Janmad Yasya Yataha, because it is like that. It is actually a commentary. So here also, Jiva Goswami is pointing out how the Bhagavatam is a commentary. Because we have this very brief statement from Vedanta Sutra, which says that if you study the jiva, then you can understand the supreme living entity. So here in the Bhagavatam is a more clear, detailed description of how that works. So it is functioning in this respect as a commentary. All right, 11.3.38 says, the soul was never born and will never die, nor does it grow or decay. It is actually the knower of the youth, middle age, and death of the material body. It can thus be understood to be pure consciousness, existing everywhere at all times and never being destroyed. Just as the life air within the body, although one, becomes as many in contact with the various material senses, so the soul appears to assume various material designations in contact with its material bodies. Let us carry on and just read through the whole of this verse 53. So there you've got a nice description of the soul and how it's distinct from the material body in subtle ways. So he's now going to explain this in 53.2. Here, Atma means the pure self, and Najajana means he was never born. Since he has no birth, the soul, the self, is also free from the next transformation, sustained existence. You know, there are six stages, transformations, that our bodies go through, or any material thing. So, being born, then being maintained, these are two of them. Nidate means he doesn't increase. Since he doesn't increase, he doesn't undergo transformation. The word he means because, the idea of logical reason. Vyabhichari nam means of all impermanent things, namely the living entities, various bodies in childhood, adolescence, and so on. In other words, different bodies in this life, or else the living entities' bodies in various species of life on a greater level, reincarnating from one lifetime to another. as a demigod, human, and other. The self is the southerner vit, the witness
of each of these stages of life. Certainly this witness is not subject to the varying conditions of what he merely observes. In answer to the question,
who is this unchanging self? Pipalayana says, he is pure consciousness, nothing but awareness. How does it exist? He says, it is eternally present everywhere throughout the body. And 53.3. So now our Buddhist friends, they're going to repeat their objection, basically. But how can we consider consciousness ever present, since we experience that after our consciousness of something blue disappears, our consciousness of something yellow appears? Two consciousnesses. They're both temporary. But no. Pipalayana answers, Indriya Balena, by the power of the senses, indicating that although consciousness is always present and is one, the power of the senses causes it to appear variegated. In other words, it is not consciousness itself that appears and disappears. Rather, what appear and disappear are the various mental states in the form of perceptions of something blue and so on. It's just the mind. The mind, what the consciousness is registering, that constant consciousness is registering different things. The mind is picking that up. Temporary mental states are therefore existing. A blue state of mind, a yellow state of mind, or a state of mind where one is mindful of blueness, mindful of yellow, mindful of this person, but then mindful of another person and you forget the first person. So these are just different states of mind which that one consciousness is being reflected in. Indriya Balena, by the power of the senses. And the mind, of course, is the sixth sense in this context. Thus, the first argument. So, you know, we are arguing a case here. We are arguing the permanence of consciousness. We are arguing the nature of consciousness. And ultimately, we're going to be arguing the absoluteness of consciousness, at least in relation to the Supreme Personality of Godhead. So there are going to be four arguments. Two of them have their roots in this verse, this 11th canto verse, 11.3.38. So the first argument presented to help identify, because here we're talking about the soul, the jiva, and we're just indicating characteristics of the absolute reality through the medium of using the jiva. So the first argument presented to help identify the absolute reality is based on the difference between the things that appear and disappear and that which is not subject to such changes. It doesn't appear and disappear. The second argument is based on the difference between the observer and the objects he observes. The example of the life here shows how something unchanging can exist in the midst of ephemeral or changing objects. So this is sort of self-evident, really, if we just look back at the verse, that there are two themes that can be found, these two arguments. There are things which appear and disappear. Then there's another thing which doesn't appear and disappear. It's always there. Then, there is an entity who is simply observing, and then there are things which are being observed. So, both these themes are actually running through the verse. Let's just read the verse again. The soul was never born and will never die, nor does it grow or decay. It is actually the knower of the youth, middle age, and death of the material body. So there you have both. You see? There you have both. You have the body growing and decaying and dying. In other words, appearing and disappearing, changing. But then you have the soul not changing, not being born. And then you have the observer and the objects observed in that he, the soul, is the knower of the youth, middle age, and death of the material body. So the material body is being observed going through those phases. They're the objects being observed, but the soul is the knower, is the observer. So there you can see those two arguments are present there. And similarly in the rest of the verse. It can thus be understood to be pure consciousness, existing everywhere at all times and never being destroyed. Just as the life here within the body, although one, becomes as many in contact with the various material senses, so the soul appears to assume various material designations in contact with its material bodies. So the same points come up there also. And the example of prana is given to illustrate how it appears that the soul, or the consciousness, is becoming many through seeing. Consciousness is seeing, another consciousness is hearing, another consciousness is thinking. So like the Buddha said, blue consciousness, yellow consciousness, so seeing consciousness, hearing consciousness, thinking consciousness. So it may seem that there are many consciousnesses. There is not a fixed consciousness. There's this fluctuating situation going on. But no, just like the prana, just like the life here, is being reflected through the senses, although there is one prana. So similarly, the soul is one, although apparently manifesting in more than one, in many, actually, forms. So is that okay? Got the two arguments. Okay, 54 is a little longer, and it's addressing the same point by discussing the next verse from Srimad Bhagavatam 11.3.39. So we're now at the bottom of page 72. Expanding further on this example, Pipalayana Rishi uses the analogy of the senses' dissolution to demonstrate the soul's changelessness. Sure, sounds deep. It is deep. This is pretty deep. So he quotes then the next verse spoken by Pipalayana, 11.3.39. The spirit soul is born in many different species of life within the material world. Some species are born from eggs, others from embryos, others from the seeds of plants and trees, and others from perspiration. But in all species of life, the prana, or vital air, remains unchanging and follows the spirit soul from one body to another. Similarly, the spirit soul is eternally the same despite its material condition of life. We have practical experience of this. This is now sort of the deeper point. When we are absorbed in deep sleep, I hope none of you are approaching that state currently, because I know it's not so easy, and when it becomes less easy philosophically, we tend to take shelter in that. But anyway, when we're absorbed in deep sleep without dreaming, the material senses become inactive, and even the mind and false ego are merged into a dormant condition. But although the senses, mind, and false ego are inactive, one remembers upon waking that he, the soul, was peacefully sleeping. Interesting point. Now, this is going to be discussed as we go further on. Here, just to clarify a few of the words, Andeshu means among those born from eggs, Peshishu among those born from worms, and so on. Different entities born in different situations. 54.2. Having thus shown the changeless quality of the life here, so the same prana is following the subtle body, following the spirit soul, from one species to another. You may have different bodies. You will have different bodies in different species, but the prana remains the same. So the soul also. The prana is changeless, the soul is changeless. So, sage Pipalayana now compares the soul to it, and in this way demonstrates that the soul is also changeless. How is this? The soul appears to be changing, either when he is in contact with his senses during waking consciousness, or when he is connected only with his ego while sleeping and dreaming, at which time his ego is filled with impressions from the waking state. But when the soul is in deep sleep, the senses and the ego become temporarily submerged or dissolved, and only the changeless, essential soul remains. How does he remain? Ashayam rite, without the containing vessel, or the limitation of the subtle body, without that. That is to say, he is free from the upadis that impose changes upon him. Let us just carry on. 54.3 will clarify further. But one may object, and who is this one who may object? It is the Buddhists again. It's our Buddhist friend. He doesn't give up easily. But one may object, when everything up to and including the ego is dissolved, then what remains? Nothing. Only a void should remain. Why then is it said that even at this time, the changeless soul is present? So, Pipalayana answers, Tad anusmritir na. We remember that. We remember it. When we, the perceivers of waking life, wake up from deep sleep, we each remember ourself as the constantly existing soul who witnessed the condition of deep sleep. We say, I slept happily for so long and was not aware of anything. Since a person cannot remember what he has not experienced, the soul must perceive the experience of deep sleep. Though this experience is indistinct because he is cut off from the objects of external sensation. So we can just explain a little bit before we go into 54.4. I don't know how clear this point is to you, but there are three states of consciousness, right? Three stages. Waking, sleeping or dreaming, and deep sleep. When you're in a state, when you're in a waking state, like we are, hopefully, now, when you're awake, then your physical body, your consciousness is within your physical body. Your consciousness is within your mind. And your consciousness is within your ego. Your sense of identity, that I am me, the usual person, as I have been for so many years. That sense of identity is there. Now, when you sleep in the dreaming state, then your consciousness withdraws from the external body. You roll around in your sleep, but you're not aware that you're rolling around. When you lie down to sleep at night, you may be on your left side. When you wake up in the morning, you may be on your right side. But you will not remember how you got from one side to the other, because your consciousness was essentially withdrawn from your body. But when you're in that sleeping or dreaming state, well, according to Pipalayana, actually, and Jiva Goswami, then even your mind is not really active. There are just some impressions associated with your ego. So your consciousness is just partially there on the mental platform, and it's sort of adhering to your ego. So some impressions. It's not like when you're awake now, your mind is full of so many things, and you're aware, and you know, your mind can function, and your intelligence can analyze. When you're in sleep, that dreaming state, your mind is not so tuned in like that. So it's not that when you're sleeping, that your mind is now functioning as normal. It's not. It is withdrawn, largely withdrawn. But some impressions are there, and they're attached to the ego. This is what he has said. And what is the result of that? That as you sleep, you have some dreams, kind of disjointed dreams, if you know what I mean. Short dreams, unreal dreams, crazy dreams sometimes. Isn't it? I think we're all familiar with dreams. It's not like now, where our minds are in an orderly state, and our minds can function, and our intelligences can function. It's not like that. It's a very limited state of something to do with that. Just some built-in impressions connected with the ego, connected with the ego as reflected in the sense that as we dream, there is the sense that I am there. I am in the dream. And sometimes, you know, if you have a bizarre dream, a frightening dream, then you wake up and it may take you a little while just to remember, oh yes, it's okay. I'm not in that dangerous situation. So, those impressions in the mind are connected with the ego in the dreaming state. But people Iyana and Jiva Goswami are saying that in the state of deep sleep, then the connection with the false ego and the impressions connected with it, that connection is broken. And then you're existing on the level of the self. In fact, in Brihadaranyaka Upanishad, there is one verse which explains how normally the consciousness, let me just see if I can find the verse, the consciousness normally is... connected to consciousness is traveling through the nervous system into the body. There's, according to Brihadaranyaka Upanishad, the consciousness, the mind, via the mind, the consciousness is spread through 72,000 nerves. But when one enters deep sleep, then the consciousness is withdrawn into one nerve, the puritat nerve, which is in the heart. And therefore, according to that statement, in a very literal sense, is just like connected up with the self. So, therefore, as Jiva Goswami was saying, the experience, when you're in deep sleep, after you've been in deep sleep, and then you wake up, then there is this sort of social habit that we have of asking someone after they've woken up, did you sleep well? Of course, we know sleep is just pure tamagun, really. So, there's nothing very nice about it. Oh yes, I had a wonderful sleep, it was great. It's not really like that, it shouldn't really be like that. But we have this habit, because we all know that if you actually go into deep sleep, and then you come out of deep sleep back to normal consciousness, then you feel very good. And you feel, oh yes, I slept very well. So Jiva, people Iyana and Jiva are saying that you are actually remembering that because you were conscious of it when you were there. But he says at the end of 54.3 that since a person cannot remember what he has not experienced, the soul must perceive the experience of deep sleep. Therefore, we wake up and they go, I slept very well, that was good. So, there's some perception of that. Even in the state, we're remembering that perception in the state. It's not that we're just feeling relaxed after sleeping. We're actually recalling the experience in that state of deep sleep. But he says, although this experience is indistinct. So it is vague. It is not that we remember, oh yes, there I was, pure spirit soul. We don't remember that. It is indistinct. Why? Because we're being cut off from the objects of external sensation. So the idea is that we're conditioned to having a mind, conditioned to having a body. So to experience something independent of those things is something unusual for us. So therefore, you know, it's a little, we cannot relate to it in very clear and direct terms. So it's an indistinct remembrance, but there's still a remembrance. So this is the idea. Saying that it's not that. He's saying that we have a subjective, a personal experience, and we recall that. We feel that, and it remains with us afterwards. There's a little further description in 54.4. We can therefore conclude that the soul, who is pure awareness, is also aware of himself. just as an entity such as the sun, which is in substance pure light, also reveals itself by that light. We find the following confirmation in Shruti. It is true that he, the soul, is not seeing, or rather that although seeing, he does not see externally visible objects, but it is not possible to remove the seer's sight altogether. So that sounds like, you know, a fairly roundabout type of statement. But he's talking about deep sleep. This is what he's talking about. That it is true that the soul is not seeing, but it's not really that. What it is that he is seeing, but he's not seeing externally visible objects. That's in deep sleep. So, in other words, consciousness remains. Consciousness remains even in deep sleep, despite what the Shanik Vijnanavadis, the Buddhists, say, that when you go to sleep, when you're in deep sleep, go beyond the dreaming state, then you're in a void. You're in that void, which is their goal. Just shows their goal is like, you know, ultimate ignorance, really. Yeah. So, but we're saying no. Pipalayana is saying no. Jiva Goswami is saying no. That you are conscious even in deep sleep. Obviously, you're conscious while you're awake. Obviously, there's some consciousness when you're dreaming. But deep sleep, yes. And what is the evidence? That afterwards you remember, oh yes, after deep sleep, oh yes, it was very nice. I slept well. Yeah. Like this. Because it is not possible to remove the seer's sight altogether. The soul is eternally conscious. So even in deep sleep, he's still conscious, but not externally conscious at all. Completely internal. So, now, two more arguments. This idea that the soul is aware even during deep sleep constitutes the third argument, which is presented to help us identify the absolute reality. That we are always conscious, even in deep sleep. So the absolute reality is also always conscious. So, and it is based on the distinction between the witness and the objects witnessed. So anyway, similar idea to the second argument, really. But here it's here it's on the basis of sleeping. And we can also understand the fourth argument, which is based on the distinction between the unhappy sufferer and the focus of ecstatic love. Well, anyway. You see, this is the next verse, which he doesn't quote. It's the next verse in the 11th Canto, chapter 3. It's verse 40, which he doesn't quote. But in the next verse, he talks about how the living entity can remove his suffering by connecting up with the Supersoul, the Supreme Personality of Godhead, through devotional service. That's 11.3.40, although he doesn't quote it. So, 55, let us just read 55. It's very brief, and it concludes this section, and it's just summing up, actually. So, these arguments can be summed up as follows. Here we have four kinds of arguments in the modes of both exclusion and inclusion. What does that mean? Negative and positive. Things which don't happen, things which do happen. Qualities which are held, qualities which are not held. Exclusion and inclusion. Four kinds of arguments. Each of them can be applied in terms of how the thing happens or doesn't happen. The first argument is based on the difference between what takes birth and dies and what does not. Change. Right? That was the verse before. Change. What changes and what doesn't? The body and the soul. The second is based on the difference between the seer and the seen. The third is based on the difference between the witness and the witnessed. Well, that's pretty subtle. The fourth argument, which is given just to aid our understanding, is based on the difference between the miserable sufferer and the focus of pure love. So when we say exclusion and inclusion, or inclusion and exclusion, I'll give you an example from these verses, that the very first point is about change. The body changes, the soul doesn't. So negatively, in the sense of exclusion, then you can say that one never sees changes like birth or death in the soul. That's a negative, that's an exclusion.
But then positively, one can say that when the soul is in the body changes. So the body changes. That's an inclusion. That's a positive point.
So he is giving arguments which are based on showing things which don't happen.
The soul changing, it doesn't happen. And by showing things which do happen, the body does change. And it changes even on the basis of the soul. So those considerations of exclusion and inclusion can be applied to all four of the arguments. Now, this rather mysterious statement about the fourth argument, I'll just read that verse. This is 11:340. It's the next verse by Pipalaya. He says, when one seriously engages in the devotional service of the personality of Godhead, fixing the Lord's lotus feet within one's heart as the only goal of life, one can destroy the innumerable impure desires lodged within the heart as a result of one's previous fruit of work within the three modes of material nature. When the heart is thus purified, one can directly perceive both the Supreme Lord and oneself as transcendental entities. Thus one becomes perfect in spiritual understanding through direct experience, just as one can directly experience the sunshine when one has healthy vision. So, we, because we are entangled in these bodies, even though philosophically it may be there that we know we're the soul, we're not the body, so on and so forth, but still we're entangled. But the fourth argument, which is explicitly stated here, to aid our understanding, is that when we connect up with Krishna, who is that ultimate consciousness, then we, who are little consciousnesses, and who have this propensity to fall down, and then end up miserably suffering, but when we connect up with Him, the Supreme Consciousness, then we, even though we are little consciousness, and we are prone to fall, but we can be saved. And then, just as He is that ecstatic, constantly ecstatic person, we can also become ecstatic like that when we develop our love for Him. So in this way, we have shown the nature of the jiva and connected it up ultimately with the nature of the Supreme Brahman. Have we done that? Sort of. Something like that. Maybe a little quickly, I don't know, but we only have another couple of days left, so we don't have much choice. Any comments or questions? It says, when one seriously engages in the devotional service of the personality of Godhead, fixing the Lord's lotus feet within one's heart as the only goal of life, one can destroy the innumerable impure desires lodged within the heart as a result of one's previous fruit of work within the three modes of material nature. When the heart is thus purified, one can directly perceive both the Supreme Lord and oneself as transcendental entities, and thus one becomes perfect in spiritual understanding through direct experience, just as one can directly experience the sunshine through healthy vision. The dreaming state, similar to the condition when we're in Mahavishnu now, is called susupti. There, our karma has been completely suspended, and we become